listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Good evening and welcome to Aloud. That police siren is our signal that it is time to start because we have the chief here tonight. A great pleasure to welcome you here tonight. I'm Louise Steinman, the program director for the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Tonight we're presenting David M. Kennedy and the Los Angeles Police Department Chief Charlie Beck in conversation with Robin Kramer, a conversation titled From Nickerson Gardens to National, An End in Sight to Violence in Inner City America. We'll learn more about Operation Ceasefire, what it's meant nationally, and what it means for us here in our own city. Award-winning criminologist David Kennedy orchestrated what's known as the Boston Miracle, a revolutionary method for gang interventions in the mid-1990s. It cut youth homicide by two-thirds and pointed the way towards what few had imagined, a real solution. Okay, it's known as the Boston Miracle, but as Kennedy writes in his new book, Don't Shoot, it wasn't a miracle. It was hard, damned work. And I think you'll hear more about that tonight from David. David M. Kennedy is now the director of the Center for Crime Prevention and Control at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. He is the author of Deterrence and Crime Prevention, Reconsidering the Prospect of Sanction, and he's served as an advisor on illicit drug and firearm markets, youth and domestic violence, and deterrence theory for the Justice Department, the Department of the Treasury, the Office of the National Drug Control Policy, and the White House, as well as for international government bodies. Kennedy was initially propelled to do something about gang violence after a visit to Watts at the height of the crack epidemic. At the time, he was a self-taught and then unknown criminologist. He set out to educate himself. He rode with beat cops. He hung out with gang members. He sat on stoops with grandmothers. And what he learned was that all parties misunderstood each other, caught in a spiral of racialized anger and distrust. David Kennedy describes this long journey in his new book, and it's a robust blend of street grit, social science, and moral clarity. As Malcolm Gladwell wrote, "Don't Shoot will do for the fight against violence what Rachel Carson's Silent Spring did for the environmental movement a generation ago." That's quite a hefty statement. With David Kennedy tonight, we have Chief Charlie Beck, has been the chief of the Los Angeles Police Department since 2009. He oversees the third largest police department in the United States, 10,000 sworn officers, 3,000 civilian employees, encompassing an area of 473 square miles, which makes us even more grateful to him for taking the time to come to the Los Angeles Public Library to talk to us tonight. He's a native of Long Beach. He was appointed to the LAPD in March 1977. He moved up from sergeant to lieutenant to captain by 1999 and commander in April 2005. And in August 2006, he achieved the rank of deputy chief, the same rank as his father, a retired Los Angeles police officer, had attained. He's renowned for his ability to forge traditional policing methods and community outreach programs to form enduring crime abatement programs. And the reduction of crime of gang violence is high on his list of priorities for the Los Angeles Police Department. And we're very fortunate to have as interlocutor tonight Robin Kramer, someone who thinks deeply and creatively about our city. She's been an active leader in LA civic affairs for over three decades. She was the first woman to hold the position of chief of staff to both Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa and Richard Reardon. And she was a senior executive at the California Community Foundation, the Broad Foundation, and Coro Southern California. And she's currently working as a senior advisor to the Annenberg Retreat at Sunninglands. It's a great panel. Be sure you have your questions to ask them. Please welcome Charlie Beck, David Kennedy, and Robin Kramer to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. It's really a pleasure to be here in this Hall of the People and with two very shy and retiring gentlemen. And to get us right into the context of the work, I thought it would be helpful for David to read a passage from this fantastic book, which is a page-turner, and about its connection and his connection to this work and Los Angeles. So it's 1985, and it begins.
So let me set the stage for you a little bit. It was just said in that lovely introduction that I started this as an unknown and self-taught criminologist. No, I wasn't. I was a kind of budding journalist, and I had this interesting job, among other things, at the Kennedy School at Harvard writing teaching cases. There were faculty at the school interested in this then not very respectable idea called community policing, and they sent me to some interesting police departments to check things out. So it is late 1985. I am in Los Angeles. I went to Nickerson Gardens because LAPD was trying a new foot patrol experiment to see if the same officers in the same area, getting to know the people and the local action, could make a difference. The place is huge, almost 60 acres, a small town of low-rise, stucco and concrete townhouse apartments, sun-bleached and pale. I didn't know it then, but I was just across the line from Compton, which some think really was ground zero for crack. It could truly have been the most dangerous place in America on that particular day. I spent the day walking with the two of them. One was tough and compact, didn't say much, ranged out like a hunting dog working the trail for game. Check this door, a look around the corner, double back for a word with that group of young men, flick forward again. Every once in a while, he'd slide by for a quick word with his partner, off again. I stayed with the partner, big, talkative, friendly. He was a magnet for the little kids. They flocked, he joked, handed out baseball cards, stopped and talked to the older women, nodded to the young men, clustered, watchful, all sinew and hard eyes. All the day, he schooled me. It was like walking with a field biologist who knows every root and branch and bird and butterfly. You're not really in the same forest they are. The cars come in from that way. See the kid walking up to the window? He's serving them. Those old men sitting at the card table, they're watching the heroin stash. It's buried over there. The dealers pay them off. We have to watch those traffic lights at rush hour. All the cars get ripped off. That guy, he's a heroin junkie, old. They can last forever if they keep eating. It's like the heroin preserves them. Crack, though, it burns them up fast. I don't think I ever got more than 18 inches from him. That's an exaggeration. If you could have seen the fear and tension, fear vision goggles, everything would have glowed white hot. The buildings would have glowed. It was like watching time-lapse photography, the gorgeous flower blooming, the clouds scudding over. But what was unfolding was the end of the world. You could see it. It was making a difference what they were doing. As bad as it was, it had recently been a whole lot worse. All day long, as we walked and stopped, older black women said, "Thank God you're here. I can come outside again." I felt like I had to do something. I took the two of them to dinner. I felt like I had to say something. "Thank you," I told them awkwardly. "I know I didn't belong there. Thank you for taking care of me." The quiet one started to laugh. I was humiliated. "No, you don't get it," he said. "It's not you. I'm not laughing at you. Those kids who were coming up all day long to get the baseball cards, the dealers were sending them. They wanted to know who you were. They never see a white guy in a suit." So all day long out there, what I was telling people, fed. "You've done us a big favor. Things are going to be really quiet for a couple of weeks." I had an absolutely visceral response to Nickerson Gardens. It was not reasoned, not moral, not mediated. It was, "This is not okay. People should not have to live like this. This is wrong. Somebody needs to do something."
So Chief Beck, you were a LAPD officer at the time, and indeed the LAPD was doing something, but violence, drug dealing continued to spiral. What was the LAPD's approach to Nickerson Gardens and the communities where violence was so prevalent at that time?
Well, Robin, in 1985, I was ironically in the exact same space and time as David was. I was a young sergeant, and I was a gang sergeant of in the South Bureau, which is all of South Los Angeles, including Nickerson Gardens. I had a long history with Nickerson Gardens. I was not only a patrol officer in that neighborhood for quite some time, but I was also a gang officer there, and I had was well versed in the ways of violence in the 80s in Los Angeles. The department at the time was about a third smaller than it is today. Crime at the time was approximately at double the levels that it is now. The Los Angeles Police Department was vastly overtasked. And for that reason, the footbeats that David was so enthralled with and were so effective eventually were abandoned because of the need to put officers in radio cars so they could do rapid response. At that point in time, the Los Angeles Police Department took total responsibility for the gang problems of Los Angeles. And while that sounds like a noble thing to do, it's really the wrong thing to do. Gang issues are society's issues. You know, if by the time they get to the level that the police are the sole solution, they are long gone, long past solution. So in the 80s, at that time, because we took sole responsibility for the issue, our primary response was a military response. You know, the 80s, mid-80s, were the time of what we called Operation Hammer, of which I was a part, where we would put 1,000 uniformed police officers on the street at one time and arrest every gang member we could come across for whatever reason we could legally arrest them for. And that response, although very popular with some, because it seems to be an active, you know, participatory, forward-moving response to an issue, really just at many levels entrenches the problem. And I know David's going to talk about that a little bit, and so will I. But that was the mindset at that particular time. And when you overlay that mindset that the police are the only response with a police department that was smaller and much busier than it is today, you get a recipe for disaster. You get a pot that always boils.
So, David, this was pretty typical of police departments and violence-prone neighborhoods all over our country. You did a great deal of research and discovered that there are several kinds of communities inside neighborhoods. And what'd you learn, and why does it matter?
Sure. So let me back into this. I'm a sort of an academic, and academics who think about these issues divide the things that control bad behavior into basic two camps. So there's what scholars call formal social control, and that's the cops and the courts and the prosecutors and all that stuff that seems so efficacious and vigorous, and it can be. And then there's informal social control, which is everything else. And so that's what you think and what your mom thinks and what your girlfriend thinks and what your potential girlfriend thinks and what your neighbors think and all that kind of thing. And everything we know says informal social control trumps formal social control. And try explaining that to a squad of gang officers. You don't get very far. And I came up with something finally, and I'll use that to jump into answer your question. So here's a question for the audience. Show of hands, please. When you were growing up, who was really afraid of the police? It's LA, so it's a few more than most. Show of hands, please. Thank you. Hands down. Show of hands, please, when you were growing up, who was really afraid of your mother? Okay. Everything you'll ever need to know about informal social control. And the main thing we want to get at here is to get that equation right. And my short version of this is mom now trumps feds later. It's true every single time. So here are the communities that, this is simplistic, but it's not too bad, that we're engaged with here. There's the community of law enforcement. So there's the cops and the prosecutors and all that. There's what we usually call the community, and by that we mean the good people in the community. And there's what I've come to call the community of the streets. So there's the gang members, the drug dealers, the folks who are active in the drug markets. And almost always, those communities are at odds. And so this is the situation that the chief was describing back then in 1985. I will say it's changed an awful lot in LA. In many places, it hasn't changed very much. And let me give it back to you after just noting one fact. So, or maybe a cluster of facts. So if you look at the community of the streets and you look at who's actively driving things in the most dangerous neighborhoods, it turns out to be a vanishingly small population. So I've got numbers in my head from Cincinnati where we've recently done this. In Cincinnati, a couple of years ago, when we first took this snapshot, 61 groups, gangs, drug crews, neighborhood sets, that kind of thing, and this world tends to present itself in these groups. 1,500 people all together across Cincinnati, 0.5% of the population of the city, 0.5%, under 0.5% actually. And that under 0.5% of the population of the city was connected with 3/4 of all killings in Cincinnati. This is a fantastically concentrated problem. And here's one more fact about that world. So we all know that the country is at the tail end, or at least a low point in a long historical crime decline. When I was walking Nickerson Gardens, the national homicide rate had gotten up to about 10 per 100,000, which was seen as a tragedy at the time. It's come down now nationally to about 4 per 100,000. In the neighborhoods I'm committed to, the young men in those neighborhoods can be dying at a rate of over 500 per 100,000 every year, which means that if you're a young black man in a dangerous poor neighborhood in the United States, more than 1 in 200 of you die every year. And in these gang circles we're talking about, we've done calculations recently in a hot neighborhood in Chicago that says your annual homicide risk, if you're in a gang in Chicago, is 3,000 per 100,000. And that community is scared to death.
And so the cops scared of this too? Is this a known fact? And what has been the arc of change in the LAPD because of this and other factors?
Well, yeah, David's numbers are absolutely right. We have a rough estimate, 40,000 documented gang members in a city of 4 million. You know, that's 1%. And they account for about 60% of our homicides. So that means that of that 40,000, about 160 primarily young men will die this year at the hands of somebody that looks primarily just like them and usually grows up within a stone's throw of their house. And that is the reality. That is the reality in Los Angeles. It has been the reality in Los Angeles, although we have reduced the numbers. It hasn't changed the reality. You know, the mid-80s was the crime rate was twice what it is now. By the mid-90s, it was three times the rate that it is now. So we have made progress, but we haven't changed the reality of the dynamic. It's still the same. We've shrunk the number of victims, but the reality remains the same. So what there are a number of factors of why the numbers have declined, primarily, and I'm getting ready to do another conference on gangs, and so we charted all the different things that we've we've tried in response to gangs. You know, we had dedicated gang units was our first thing. We're officers that are dedicated, that's all they do is work gangs. And I was in the first group that did that in Los Angeles. And then the state developed a statewide gang identification system. And so we did a number of these elegant tactical responses that made little progress, you know, locked a lot of people up, but didn't really change the numbers. And when we really started to make progress was when we began to focus our efforts on individuals that were in the upper hierarchy of the gangs. And then when we also recognized that we were not the only solution, and that we started opening our tactics up to include people that could intervene in violence. And by intervening in violence, they opened the discussion so that finally we can break the barriers down so that police officers could do what was unthinkable when I was a gang cop, which is actually have a conversation with somebody that we would have, in my time, classified as the enemy. And so, you know, much of this is what David preaches in Ceasefire, and what we talk about in the Gang Reduction and Youth Development Office out of the mayor and my current gang units, is that you can't look at this as a war on gangs. You have to look at this as a war on violence. And so you're not going to achieve the result that we deserve, this city deserves, by demonizing individuals. You have to concentrate on their activity. So that's what we've done.
And how does this work? How does this intervention, which is planful and had a lot of starts and stops, you've learned a great deal. How does it really work?
So the first piece was recognizing this concentration, that it's not the neighborhood, it's not kids, it's not a people, it's not some of the other awful things that people think. It's a tiny, tiny, tiny number of standout individuals. So the practical work that the book talks about starts in Boston in 1995, and the gang cops in Boston taught us that the violence came back to these groups. They're both the overwhelming offenders. They're also the overwhelming victims. They hurt each other more than anybody else. People ask me if I'm scared out there sometimes, and what I learned was they don't care about me. I'm no threat. They're not going to bother me. They don't worry about me. They worry about each other. And the cops in Boston had come up with a fantastically clever way of getting them to stop, which they then taught to us. And what they did was go out to these groups and say, "Don't shoot." And they meant it. And they would go face to face. They would find the group in the city that was the most out of control. And they would say to them, "Until you put your guns down, we are going to enforce the law." And so gang members are profligate sinners. They sell drugs, they use drugs, they carry weapons, they're on probation, parole, they violate their terms and conditions, they've got outstanding warrants, they sell drugs, they use drugs, drive unregistered cars, all this kind of stuff. And the sort of old school that the chief is describing is, we go after everybody for everything all the time. And that essentially means we don't get anybody for everything they do at nearly any time. They get away with almost everything. So the Boston cops turned that on its head, and they went to particular gangs. These were just loose drug crews for us, but they called them gangs. And they said, "We know who you are, we know what you're doing, we are here because of the violence, and until the violence stops, we are going to use all our legal powers against the entire group." And then they would do it. And what that meant was that if you were in this gang, you had no fun, you made no money, you got away with nothing, you did not look strong in front of your boys, you did not look strong in front of your girls, and they didn't like it. And over and over and over again in Boston, it turned out that they would put their guns down and retreat from their feuds and such in order to have things go back to the status quo. It was not a negotiation. They didn't get to deal drugs. It just, the special attention went away. So the first big light bulb was that you could do that. And the Boston Miracle, so-called, was simply taking that citywide and saying something to the gangs like, we're talking to all of you. The next gang that kills somebody is where all of our attention is going to go. And the city did that a couple of times, and lo and behold, nobody wanted to be that first gang after that statement was made every time, and you basically cooled the whole city off. But then we learned some other really amazing things. So one was that the gangs liked it, which was the last thing that anybody expected. So gangs started coming to the group I was working with and quietly looking around and saying, that gang over there, they're getting out of control. You've got to do something about them. They're going to ruin it for everybody. Seriously. And then the other, you know, the next light bulb went off. They're better off than they were before. They're safer. We're saving their lives. Why would they want to go back? And you have to think terrible things about people in order to think they would rather live in a war zone than not live in a war zone. And we do think those terrible things, but they're wrong. We learned that they would listen to their own community. It didn't have to be a legal threat. It could be a statement of aspiration and expectation from people they respected.
Like
their mothers. I mean, this is the point of that whole story, right? We write these communities off, and we say nobody there cares about anything, and that is just absolutely, completely wrong. Gang members care about lots of people, and the question then became, who do they care about, and how do you organize them to intervene in these ways? They care about their mothers. They care about their grandmothers. They care about their fathers. They're desperately concerned about their little brothers and sisters, their elders and original gangsters and such that they will listen to. So these are, in part, the interventionists who have become so important in Los Angeles. I've met Sister Soljan Jordan Downs, who by herself can calm that whole place down. They will listen to her. And it turns out you can organize that so that you can work with those voices in the community to say to the gang members, don't shoot. And most of the time, most of them will listen.
What kind of an effort does it take to bring together law enforcement, which is not just monolithic and not just police, it's probation and parole and the justice system, and how's that go? How hard is that for this kind of an effort?
Well, it gets harder every day because of the state's in collapse, and this, you know, makes what we do in the ceasefire model even more difficult. So we get who we can get. A lot of it is the demonstration of authority. You know, it is the demonstration, the perception that the whole system is allied in this role. So sometimes it's not as important that we get everybody, is that we get a variety of folks. You know, my opinion on this is that the ceasefire model, especially the call-in piece, works best on the least sophisticated gangs. You know, the ones that don't have hierarchy and that are the most typical. And so that lack of sophistication doesn't work well with understanding who's not there from the criminal justice system. So it's not that important to me.
And say more about the call-in, that's what you called it. What is that?
It's a way to talk to people. So some of you have probably read something about this, and I will say from my end that if I read a lot of the stuff that was written about this, I'm positive that I wouldn't understand it. It's a lot simpler than people think, right? So in this stuff that we've been laying out, you have to talk to the streets, all kinds of ways. You need to say, there's something we care about more than everything else. We have priorities. We particularly care about the violence. It doesn't mean we're going to give a pass on everything else, but we really care about the violence. The community needs to be able to say, we care about you, but there are a few things you're doing that we absolutely disapprove of. We organize social service providers, and we want to say, here's the number you call if you and the folks in your set want out, all kinds of things like that. You can't raise your kids without talking to them. You know, why would we think we could do something about this without talking to the people that we're concerned about? So you have to talk to them, and there are all kinds of ways you can do that, but there's this device that has been developed that just works really well. So we're back to the gangs and the groups and the sets and sometimes the drug markets, these standout concentrations where this problem roots itself. So if we're talking about gangs, you can identify the gangs, the street officers and often community people and outreach workers, and they know who the gangs are. You can identify the individuals in the gang. It is the nature of gangs and gang members that in any given gang, somebody's going to be on probation and parole. You know, they just are because they're so busy. And that means that you can work with probation and parole, you can identify those people, you can have them come to a meeting as a condition of their supervision. That's a call-in. And they walk in, they see the service providers and the community people and all of the law enforcement agencies that the chief is talking about. And you can talk to them. And it's not really about the guys in the chairs in the room. The first thing that they hear is, you are here, first of all, you're going to go home. This is not a sting, it's not a trick, we're not arresting you. Thanks for coming, thanks for your time. Relax.
You serve lemonade or?
We do these days, actually, sometimes, yeah. We learned that from the folks in Raleigh. Yeah, we do. But you are here as a messenger back to your group. You are here because you are a member of a group that we are concerned about, that we want to talk to, that we want to help. And when you leave here in an hour, please take what you hear back to your group. And it just turns out that that works really well.
I'm curious to know, this is very hard work, and hard work over time, and not a straight line to results. So what have been the biggest mistakes you've made or your work, in your work? And what have you learned from those mistakes?
So I think The biggest mistake that I made was taking on too many of the preconceptions, and in one core way in particular. So we see these, what I now think of as communities, as antagonists. So everybody laughed when I said the gang members came in and said, we want you to stop them because we don't want things to go back. And we laughed because that's so incongruous, right? And everybody laughed when I said the mothers trump the feds. And that is kind of incongruous, I get that. But when we're talking about these communities, we think that's particularly incongruous because these communities, we think, don't have that kind of moral power. Right, we've written these communities off, most of us, and without being disrespectful to my many, many, many beloved law enforcement partners, especially in law enforcement, people tend to write these communities off. So that the chief said, we said we'd do it alone, and part of what I'm going to say, I think he meant, is that people in law enforcement thought they had to do it alone because they didn't think they had any friends in these communities. And if you get to know the communities, you learn that they have awful, awful, awful views of the rest of us, and especially people in law enforcement. So there's a really dominant narrative in many of these neighborhoods, and this is most strongly voiced in African-American distressed neighborhoods, that all of this is going on, the violence, the drugs, the heavy enforcement, everything, because we on the outside have set things up so that we can do that to them. And many people have heard this. Everybody in law enforcement has heard it, but it's the idea that the CIA invented crack and brought it into the neighborhoods, and all the drug enforcement is just another way, now that we've gone through the civil rights era, we needed a new way to do damage to the community, and we came up with this, we pumped the drugs into the neighborhood, and now we're arresting all the young men because we needed another way to do what we had always done to them by other means. And we could continue. You know, the cops think the guys on the corner are sociopaths and they don't really care if they live or die.
And what I did is what I think all of us do, whatever community we come up in, and that is absorb that and think it was true. And the most important thing that I've learned, and the reason that I am now hopeful that we can get out of where we are on this, I mean, in a very immediate, direct way, is that none of that stuff is right. Right? The cops are not conspiring with the CIA to flood the neighborhoods with drugs and crack. The law enforcement would love for this to stop if they could figure out some way to help make that happen. The guys on the corner are not sociopaths. They want to be safe. They will actually work with us sometimes to be safe. The community is not corrupt. It is angry, and the anger makes it silent. And what the rest of us see is that silence, and we read it as approval and tolerance, and as my narcotics friends say, everybody's living off drug money. No, they're not. And the big move that should have been obvious all along is to recognize that nobody likes this. And that there is some common ground, which is about fundamental public safety and domestic tranquility that everybody wants, and that we can actually move to that really quickly.
Resonate for you, Chief?
Well, you know, David and I agree on much more than we disagree about. All our disagreements are just in minor issues that have to deal with Los Angeles. He's absolutely right. You know, the way that we've done this, the silos that we set up, you know, separating narcotics from gangs and the belief that the community wouldn't help us, you know, that's all wrong. And I think that in Los Angeles, you know, we've been able to realize the benefits of embracing, you know, all the people that want the same thing. I would be remiss if I didn't mention Father Greg Boyle, who's in the audience, who is who is somebody that when I was a gang sergeant, I was told to stay away from. And, you know, unless I had evil intentions. But who I have come to view as one of my greatest allies in making this a safer city. And, you know, and that's, you know, I think that's maybe the thing that I've learned is this is not about individuals. It's about their actions. It's about violence. And, you know, while I would love that there be no street gangs, I don't think that's a realistic ambition. Now, I do think that we could have street gangs that didn't rely on violence to solve all their disputes. So I think that is a realistic ambition. And it's when you realize that, is that you can't do everything, but you can do something really important, which is stop violence, that you're able to start making some progress towards that. And that's really kind of the core of David's and my agreement on this, is that you have to target the right thing. And if you try to target whole communities or whole groups of people, then all you do is make them stronger as a unit, and you don't actually solve the problem.
We in Los Angeles, we like to think we're very special, and I'm curious to know if there's anything unique about the culture of gangs here, which have a long history, which are multi-ethnic, our geography, which is different from these other cities where you've been. Is there anything that presents a special challenge or even an opportunity for this approach here?
Yeah, there is. I was going to say this anyway, but now you've given me a proper opportunity, so that's even better. So what I'm about to say is going to sound like your absolutely characteristic, meaningless politeness, and anybody who picks up the book and reads it will recognize that I have absolutely no reluctance to insult anybody. So please take this at face value, because it is absolutely true. And that is that you have, in particular, an enormous breakthrough asset in what you just heard from Chief Beck. All right, so this is, I have been involved with this department episodically from 1985 until now. And up until about 5 years ago, it was pretty much what I recognized it as being in 1985 all the way through. It is not the same department now. And one of the, it's different in a lot of important and wonderful ways. I paid a site visit here relatively recently, I don't know exactly, 18 months, 2 years ago, as part of our initial work about what we're doing now in the mission. And I did not recognize it. I mean, I really didn't. And that's a good thing, let me tell you. And the shift that you have just heard that says this is about the killing, it's not about the neighborhoods, it's not about the gangs, we are not going to get rid of the gangs, we are not involved in a twilight struggle with the gangs, we are about safety, and that's something that we will prioritize above all else, and that we will get there, is still, it's a breakthrough in Los Angeles, and this man, if you can put this in a person, has carried that idea, and you have no idea what it takes to punch that through in police culture and make people understand it and embrace it and own it, which is what's happened in LA. But most departments in this country would not say that. They haven't gotten there yet. And because he is so right about that, that is work that we can do. And yes, there are things that are different about Los Angeles. The gang structure matters, the geography matters, the staffing strength matters, you know, all is funding, it all matters. But it doesn't matter as much as that shift, because this one we can win. He's right.
So say a bit more about how that shift in the department actually happened. It could be embodied in the chief or the police commission or the mayor, but for the men and women on the street and those who lead them, how did that happen?
Well, you know, I won't claim that this is the universal idea of every Los Angeles police officer, because that's not true. But we are nothing if, and Mark Leap's there, and Mark was one of my bosses for many years, and he knows this. This is a paramilitary organization that is very good at following direction from its leadership. And so that's been a bad thing, but it's a good thing for this. We have absolutely mandated, and we have a number of performance metrics that check to make sure it's done, that our gang units and our gang detectives work with intervention. And so they do that, but the real, the bottom line of this is rooted in the same thing as the way police culture wants to take the blame and the credit for everything. You know, we're all people that want to fix things, and so we want to take credit for it. But when something works, we don't care what it is, and this has proven to work. You know, we began. We've had a decline in crime in Los Angeles for the last 9 years, but it's really only been the last 4 years that gang crime has declined. And that's been in the time that we have begun to target those that are the most violent rather than the whole group, in the time that we've begun to embrace intervention as a way to stop violence, in the time that we've begun to understand the importance of preventive services and the consolidation of all those services under the mayor's auspices, and the time that we've begun to realize how important reentry is, which is one of the primary things that Father Boyle does. You know, that I say this all the time. We've had a fantastic reentry program for young men, young gang members leaving prison in Los Angeles for many, many years. Unfortunately, it's run by the street gangs of Los Angeles. They have a They have a reentry program that satisfies all needs. But that shouldn't be that way. So we have to understand that many of these things, these burdens are ours. So I think it's a message from the top, Bill Bratton's faith in me to try something different. You know, when we first started talking about this, it was, well, that's that hug-a-thug stuff that, that's done in one of those towns back there. But I think that the reality is that the difference has been is that instead of being led by criminologists and social services, this partnership has been led by the police department in Los Angeles. And we have worked on these relationships, and I think that's what's been making it work. We have a long, long way to go, and certainly it will take generations within the police department. Luckily, generations are fairly small in the police department, 10 years a generation. But this will be a complete shift.
I'm just going to ask two more quick questions and then open the floor to you all. So the first is, David, there are parts of your book where you are not really that kind to members of the media and for their sins of omission or commission. So I'd like to ask, if you were the editor, and editors mattered, but if you were the editor and could offer one piece of helpful, constructive advice to those who report on violence in the inner city, what is the constructive bit of advice you'd offer up? They have a job to do, too.
Yep, they absolutely do. That is a really, really good question. And what do I think the answer is? I think it is that I would have them do by design what I did essentially by accident, which is spend time with the frontline folks. What I found, and I was shocked by it, so two things. So one is the amazing insight that doing the work at the street level or at the front line or the agency level for a career tells you, lets you learn about what's going on. And my world doesn't know this. You don't get any props in academia for going to the street. You can hardly get away with it, in fact. And that's really stupid and counterproductive. So folks who want to understand this, I teach this to my students, get out of your office and go to the streets and find people. They will show you around. They will give of their wisdom. They will show you everything you need to know. And I think I had a second thing, but I can't remember what it is. I think that may be so much the most important first thing.
There's time. It might come back to you. What about you, sir? Anything to add?
Well, the media has changed so much in the last few years in Los Angeles, and this is a media center. I mean, the coverage is very shallow. There nobody spends any time on any particular story. It's all driven by a very, very short attention span. And so that is the big issue with the media in Los Angeles. It's just too shallow. And it goes back to what David's saying. They need to, this is a very complex issue. this is not just about some bad young men that need to get locked up. And it's not just about brutal police officers that are unfeeling in a community. It's not just about any of that. It is much more complex. And, the stories in that of the housing developments, of six, seven generations of Grape Street gang members in Jordan Downs, that's a powerful story, that doesn't get told. I mean, the officers know it. The people that live in the housing development know it, but it doesn't get told. And so many of these big social issues, like you know, is public housing the right way to do this? You know, should we look at a better model? These things don't get looked at. You know, we look at the story of the moment, police shooting or, you know, a tragic, you know, gang members shoot at each other and hit a child, or, you know, which is awful, but we don't look at the big issue, and the media needs to look at the big issues, which is not, doesn't fit into a small article, doesn't fit in a 30-second bit on Fox News. It's just too deep, and so we need to look at it a different way.
You know, when I started working for the city more recently and I heard police officers say we can't arrest our way out of this, then one knew it was the beginning of of the potential for change. And so a question that arises similarly, if this kind of approach, common sense approach, has the potential to work with gangs, does a similar kind of planful, forceful intervention, could it work with terrorists? What do you think?
So there's a Marine intelligence lieutenant recently back from his tours in both Iraq and Afghanistan who knew one of our partners in the Cincinnati work that's described in the book and who had his light bulb go off and decided that actually there were lessons that could be drawn. And he's drafted it up. It's circulating in some very interesting military circles. I don't know anything about that world. People that do say it's not a ridiculous idea. I think the chief is about to go off to London. And the last time I was in London talking about this stuff, somebody asked that same question. Mm. And I said, I don't know anything about this, but people I know say it's not ridiculous. And that one of the interesting things they say is that gangs are not the monolithic terrorist enterprise that we paint them as. They say that terrorists aren't either, and that if you actually are close to jihadi groups, they have a lot of the same characteristics. They're young men, they egg each other on, they've been picked up by ideas about Islam that actually are not Islamic, that they're scared, but they egg each other into stupid things. And one of my tutors on this talks about the phenomenon of jihadi cool, which is apparently very strong among jihadis. And so I said, you know, there might be reasons that you could map this on. And when I finished talking, an Arab gentleman surrounded by security, sitting right over here, stood up and said, I'm Saudi and we do that. We find jihadis and they're easy to identify. We know who they are. We sit them down. We bring in conservative, meaning non-jihadi clerics. And the clerics sit down with these young men and say, you have been taught that jihad is the sixth pillar of Islam. We are co-religionists. We believe in the same received scripts. I say you're wrong. Let us study together. And he says, and they win the arguments because they're right. And then he got this twinkle in his eye and he said, and we do it with their mothers. So, okay. You know, maybe it's not ridiculous.
So, mothers, fathers, and others, your questions, please. We are going to have some microphones around, so please, here.
Yes. When I was a kid, we had a policeman who ran our Boy Scout troop, and so we knew the police were okay. But if you saw a policeman on the street, he always had a scowl, so we were afraid maybe of the scowls. And now in Rampart, we have what we call a JIP program, which is similar, a little bit more exercise for the kids. And that seems to have calmed things down in Rampart, except now we're getting police shot at, and we're getting more grand theft automobiles. Now, I can see how you can talk to gangs and get them to not shoot each other, but how do you approach automobile thefts and things like that? Do you have any ideas for that sort of thing? And why now shooting at police when it seems to be calming down otherwise?
Well, this year assaults on police officers are up in Los Angeles. They're not any worse than they were in 2007. They're about on the same pace they were in 2007. They're just higher than they were last year. So, you know, it's a small universe. There's about 150 of them this year, which sounds like a lot. But in, you know, my book of business is about 100,000 Part 1 crimes a year. So it is a small proportion. So I think it's dangerous to draw conclusions that there's some kind of a war on police just based on a couple of incidents. So I wouldn't say that. And auto thefts are actually one of the big success stories in not only Los Angeles but in the nation. And I'd love to take credit for it, but it's actually the credit actually goes to the car manufacturers. The old cars that were easy to steal are rapidly disappearing and being replaced by new cars that are hard to steal, so auto thefts are down significantly. And in L.A., they're down about 14% this year, and they were down last year. Although that doesn't help you if your car got stolen in Rampart last week.
So I want to talk about grandmas and mamas and how you reach them and you educate them, because I'm not working with the same population you were talking about, but I'm in East L.A., and I hear so many stories about how grandma tries to keep those boys off the street, right, with her living room, which is the center for everybody to come and smoke weed, because that's considered to be a way of keeping them off the streets and doing worse things. And yet then I hear from the boys, well, they're just that. I mean, look what grandma's doing. This is, you know, why is what we're doing any worse than what grandma's doing? So how do you educate grandma and mama? I mean, how do you do that? Because I agree, that's important. Because they do respect them. They will listen to them. And yet they see them doing this. It may be a lesser thing, and grandma's thinking, oh, it's not as serious. But what do you do?
I don't hear any stories of gunplay in there.
No, there's right?
So,
but it's indirect. I mean,
actually, it's not right now. So this is the first time I've heard that an argument. That marijuana is a gateway drug to drive-bys. That's a new one on me. I don't believe that's how it works. Right. So. There are a lot of communities in which people sit around in their living rooms and smoke a lot of weed and don't shoot anybody. We call them the suburbs. And a lot of what makes the kind of thing that I'm talking about work is, are we being recorded? I can't say this the way I usually say it. It's saying that that's not true. Right, in some very direct ways. So the if that's going to edge over into shooting and really serious mayhem, then those young men, and it's really a group of young men thing, right? These are stories we tell each other. In the sociology of gangs, this is called techniques of neutralization. And David Matza, who wrote this great book in the 60s called Delinquency and Drift, it's about 150 pages long, and it will tell you everything you ever needed to know about gangs. And one of David's points is that the young men who do this turn our own standards against us. And they say things like, why should I stop what I'm doing, fill in the blank, because look at what grandma's doing. And the problem comes when we get engaged in that debate because we lose it. What we need to say to them is, cut the crap. We're not having this. There's a conversation about weed and other things, and that's conversation. We are talking about shooting people, killing people, destroying the neighborhood, tearing it up. And let's not get into a fine debate about why that's different. We all know it's different. We're not getting sucked into this. At which point they say, okay, you're not quite the manipulatable idiot I thought you were. I get it.
Please.
Do you see any parallels between the gangs and the drug cartels in Mexico?
Yes, in that they are groups. In that, well, it turns out to be a huge, big deal, right? groups and networks behave in ways that individuals don't, right? They just do. And they're approachable in ways that groups and that individuals aren't. And none of them are behaving as deliberately and rationally as we think they are. And we do not take full advantage of our opportunities to influence their behavior. So my friend Mark Kleinman, raise your hand, Mark, is in the audience here. He's one of the other national thinkers really making progress in this way of sort of thinking about doing intervention. Can I trot this out? Okay, so Mark has been actually talking with the U.S. and the Mexican government about the following idea, which is that we keep a league table, you know, a list of the cartels by their level of dangerousness. This turns out to be something you can do with reasonable accuracy. You can assign the bodies. You can say this cartel killed more people than that cartel. And what we do to persuade them not to do that is we keep people on our side of the border from buying from them. So if you talk to the DEA will say, yes, we understand the movement of drugs and money well enough to know who is buying from those cartels in order for further distribution in the United States. And we can stop that. We can make our people's lives so miserable that they will stop buying from those people, even if they go someplace else to buy. We can stop them from buying from that cartel. And the idea is that we could train the Mexican cartels that it's bad for business to kill a lot of people and create what would be, in effect, a race to the bottom of that list. And Mark has a story, because Mark and I say these things to the people in our world, and they say, you have got to be kidding. You are such a moron. Where did that idea come from? And it turns out that this is under live discussion in Mexico. Right? They thought about this and are pretty intrigued by it. Would it work? I don't know. Right? But the way all of this work has progressed is by having these ideas that everybody thinks are moronic, and then it turns out that they work. So Mark's moronic idea has a very nice track record behind it.
Please, Anne.
I'm sorry, we have a mic up here.
Oh, the mic's up there. We'll go this way, then this way, okay? Sorry.
For the last few years, I've been a school teacher in the edge of Inglewood down by Van Ness in Manchester. And it's many of the parents of the students who are very deeply concerned about their kids are also gang members, and some of the kids in eighth grade are beginning to be part of gangs. But and there's violence there. One kid's uncle killed another kid's father and caused a lot of trouble at the school. But the thing is that there's another kind of violence, and this I am not about to like run out a liberal truism, you know, but there's a violence of poverty that rips through these schools and through these kids' lives, through the parents' lives. And on one hand, it is a separate question from the particular violence that happens with gangs. On the other hand, it sure as hell is related. And how do we change the dialogue so that isn't just like some asterisk that, oh, well, we'll vote for some idiot. You know what I mean? It's like, this is a daily problem, and it is violence. Kids don't have enough food to eat. They have crappy clothes, and anybody who tells them that things are equal and everybody can be what they want to be is a damn liar, you know? How do we change the conversation on all this stuff so it gets real?
Well, good question.
Of course, that is a huge question that probably is beyond the scope of a chief of police. But I'll say this I understand that, and we do a lot of dealing with issues that are not of our making. Obviously, that's our job. But what you bring up is extremely valid. You know, what our schools in Los Angeles need more attention. They are the breeding ground for the problems that we're talking about today. If kids can't go to school because they're afraid of violence, if they can't get to school because they have to cross through rival gang turf, if they are afraid to study in school when and if they get there, because of the peer pressure that demands that nobody succeed, then we fail. And I think that this discussion has to be, you know, poverty is a huge issue, but just the quality of our schools is just as important as this discussion.
David.
Probably we've had it at a different time. No?
So I'm about to prove that I am not a nice person. So you said we have to deal with this, and with all due respect, I want to say no, we don't. It's a feature of the way we talk about these issues, right? So the chief and I are both up here saying people are getting killed in massive numbers, not so much in LA anymore, which is entirely to LA's credit. But there's still some very bad neighborhoods in Los Angeles. There are now worse neighborhoods in many cities all over the country. And what we're saying is, and me in a sort of more strategic and single-minded way than the chief, who's been talking about a lot of different sorts of interventions. I've been working on some very particular ones that simply have tremendous voltage. And they work, right? So we know that now. And it is a feature of the way we talk about that issue that when we say we can keep these kids alive, we can keep them from getting locked up, we can eliminate the open-air drug dealing that surrounds their homes, it feels like a moral imperative to say, that's not nearly good enough. What are we doing about everything else? And it's a reason that we don't do the work that is ready to hand, because we make what we feel morally obligated to do so large that we end up doing nothing. And it's really different in other walks of life. So I work a lot with trauma surgeons. And when a trauma surgeon saves one of these kids and goes out and tells his parents that his son isn't going to die, nobody says to him, you're a failure, what are you doing about his third grade reading scores? And we need to separate this stuff. It is not to say the other part isn't important, but if we make this about everything, it becomes about nothing and we stay where we are.
David, I've been following this, your writing, for about 20 years now, I guess, and I know that when the original Boston Project had a tremendous amount of community involvement, you had representatives from every agency that were part of it, and that proceeded for a number of years, and then something happened, but I don't know what it was, and I wondered if what's happening in Boston today as a result of those experiences.
Yep. So what the questioner is referring to is the fact, and it is a fact, and even the city acknowledges it now, which it didn't for a long time, that ceasefire, as we called it, worked. It was in place in Boston for about 5 years. The city let it fall apart. The killing came back. And let me talk about that for a minute, and then I'll talk about what came next. So what was absent in Boston is what I'm giving the chief credit for, which is a solid, pragmatic, unrelenting managerial and administrative commitment to doing the work that needs to be done. None of our agencies are perfect, but they need to be kept on track. And the Boston Police Department is at the root of this. It's a bigger story than that. But the fact, the main fact is that the Boston Police Department knowingly stopped doing this work for reasons that don't matter very much here, and the killing came back, and that there was not the leadership to fix that. That changed when current police commissioner Ed Davis came in 4 or 5 years ago now, and he is systematically putting ceasefire back in place, and in fact the homicide has rather steadily, the violence has been coming back down.
Please.
Tie in a couple of things you guys said. The killings seem to be motivated because of money. It's not got that's nothing to do with it.
Not nothing, but actually not very much.
There's a model right down here at the Nickel, 5th and Town. And I frequented that place for 25 years as a user. And I saw gang members working together from different gangs in an open market, selling narcotics, which I was a customer of. It seems like nobody got hassled there. The buyers came and got what they wanted, and they walked away. It almost seems like what they did in Boston was happening in downtown LA despite itself. Now, to me, as a recovering addict, when you concentrate something, it's easier to see the problem. When we're trying to put out all these fires all over town, it gets harder to put out 100,000 fires. But when it's one fire and it's in concentrated area, you can focus all your energy on education, so on and so forth, to deal with the problem. Do you think decriminalizing drugs, which have a big bearing on what these gangs make their money from, not decriminalizing, but I don't know what I'm trying to say. Do you see what I'm saying? There's a neighborhood that was there for 25 years, and we knew where the problem was, and there wasn't that much killing there because you just was bad for business to kill somebody that comes in. I went, got my stuff, got loaded, got out. My question is, would a model like that on a bigger scale in different neighborhoods, would that help calm the killing? Would, I don't know how to put this, man. I don't know what
I think we got it.
It's kind of a misconception in Los Angeles that especially now that killings are drug related. There are drug related killings, but the vast majority of them are about pride and neighborhood and old vendettas and who looked at whose girlfriend at a party. And I mean, they're for things that nobody in this room would probably think were of consequence. Now, during the crack epidemic, you know, of the 90s, we had plenty of drug-related killings. But the reality is that the corners are rapidly disappearing, or the drug markets are open air drug markets are rapidly disappearing throughout Los Angeles, and those kind of killings have largely diminished. But we're still left with what the focus of David's work is, and the focus of my problem, young men, 18 to 25, killing each other over, you know, social beefs. It's not about drug markets anymore.
I appreciate what you all have said. I was wondering, in terms of the fact that because of prison overcrowding, there are 9,000 people that are going to, we're beginning to be released on October 1st, will be coming into Los Angeles. There are those who are concerned that during their time in jail, they have learned a lot about how to do dangerous things and so on. I was wondering what you would suggest in terms of, or the plans are for these people that are being released from the prison system.
Well, you know, the tragedy is that they're being released, and the ability to monitor their activity post release has disappeared. You know, it's not so much that they're getting out, because they would have got out anyway. And that's, you know, the reality is that people get released, but it's the lack of services, the lack of monitoring, the total abandonment by the state of their what has normally been their responsibility. Now, you know, we'll see what the county and the city are able to do with this. You know, this is very much building a plane while we're flying it, which is not a very good way to do this. You know, this is of significant concern and a topic of a lot of effort and debate right now. So.
We take two more questions, Ron.
Yeah, one, then two, then back to me.
Chief, this is more directed towards you and kind of a follow-up question to what she was saying. Recently with AB 109 and the N3 population that's being released, do you anticipate an influx in gang violence? And if so, are there any reentry programs or anything forecasted for the LAPD to deal with that? I know the Sheriff's Department's in the process of developing reentry services, working with Homeboy Industries and Amity and other foundations, WineGuard. Are you guys participating in that, and do you guys have a plan such as that?
Well, you know, we've been part of the development of all the sheriff's strategies, and actually, it's really our probation system that's going to take the brunt of this, especially the services. We're going to assign about 100, actually twice as many officers as the sheriff is assigning, 150 versus their 75, to assist probation. with ensuring that, that folks get the services and that they're meeting the conditions that, that the county puts on them. It's going to be very difficult, though, because the amount of funding that's put into services, which is something that, that everybody agrees folks need when they get out of when they get out of custody, has been cut in half, literally, and will probably end up being even more diminished than that as we have to build other systems to replace what parole used to do. So I mean, it's going to be very difficult. But we are the problem for the LAPD is that the funding that is going to go towards programs is under the control of the county. So in the city of Los Angeles, it makes it much more difficult.
Last question.
My question is for both Chief Beck and for Mr. Kennedy about gun policy and the degree to which gun policy was coordinated with the kinds of efforts that you have been engaged in or not.
Well, you know, guns are a huge factor in violence in Los Angeles. You know, we have a number of gun strategies that work in conjunction with our gang strategies. You know, our gun buyback programs, I have 20 detectives that all they do is make sure that prohibited possessors don't buy ammunition or guns. You know, a number of things that we do in order to keep as many guns off the street as possible. The reality is that gun violence is gang violence in Los Angeles. I mean, that's how young men are killed, is by the handgun. And if we can limit the number of guns in our population, then I can limit violence.
So one of the things I remembered, which I had forgotten when I sat down to write this, is that first time I was in L.A., which was the couple of weeks that I first visited Nickerson Gardens, I rode patrol, I rode helicopters, I did a lot of stuff with LAPD. And I didn't know then what I know now, which is that it's not normal to get man with an Uzi calls over the radio. Because it was then. I don't think it is anymore, but it was then. And actually, that was the thread that drove a lot of my thinking. And the Boston Gun Project, which begat Operation Ceasefire, so that the work that we began with the Boston Police Department in 1995 had as its central idea that we ought to do something about the illicit markets that were delivering guns to kids. So that this is a story this room will understand. The very first conversation I ever had about what became all this stuff was with Bill Bratton when he was commissioner in the Boston Police Department. He was way out front on the Brady Bill, the can't buy a gun if you've got a felony record bill. And I'd been doing this gun market stuff, and I had a conversation with him about how the fact was that wouldn't reach kids killing kids in Boston because the kids were getting guns illegally. They were already prescribed purchasers. It's not about gun control in the way we usually talk it. It's not about good people with guns. All of this was illegal, and at the time it was getting almost no enforcement. So part of Ceasefire actually was what turned out to be a meaningful intervention that traced the guns, traced the crime guns, identified the ways they were flowing to the streets, and mobilized enforcement action against those illegal gun markets. The Clinton administration took it all over the country. We were in 60 cities, and when the Bush people came in, they shut it down. That's a fact. But the other side of this is that the other piece turned out to be more meaningful. So my feeling at this point is that we ought to dramatically enhance, not gun control. Most legitimate people with guns are never going to shoot anybody. But the ways that drug dealers and gangbangers buy guns, that we should be paying a whole lot more attention to. But this other stuff we're talking about has more voltage. Doing something about kids killing guns doesn't end the animosity between law enforcement and communities. It doesn't mobilize those community voices. It doesn't help the gang members except in the immediate way that it makes them safer. And so I've come to think of that as an important supporting element, but I don't think any longer that it's a game changer.
So this has been a very interesting, complex conversation. It gives me a great deal of pause and also hope. I want to thank all of you for joining us tonight, and these two gentlemen of such toughness, courage, and also love. I also want to encourage you, if you are not a member of the Library Foundation, to be a virtuous person and join. And as we adjourn, our author is available to sign your book, and I hope you will read it, learn from it, and become engaged. Thank you all very much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.